I'm not going to give a quiz today. Let me just make one comment, though, about where we are in this course. You know, this is a course that continues on the next quarter. That general outline I gave you of week-by-week progression, we're somewhat ahead of where I thought we would be at this point. In other words, I think that went up to Abraham, and we're Isaac, Jacob. So we're down the line a bit. We'll move on into Joseph today. That's going to help us next quarter, because it'll mean that we'll have more time to do things next quarter, so that's good. But as someone asked me this at the end of the last hour, they wondered if I was only going to test up to Abraham. Unless there's any confusion on that, the final exam will cover up till the day. So I won't follow that projection of where we would be at this time. You know, it's hard to project in a course like this. How far you go depends an awful lot on how much interaction and discussion there is. There's a lot of discussion. It means you get slowed down in how much you can cover. And usually what that means is, and I at certain points eliminate certain things, you know, to really get through to the end where we want to get. But there's a lot of leeway as far as give and take as to what we can do in class, depending on your interest in pursuing certain things and so forth. So that's the reason for that. We were at number four under F at the end of the last hour. That is, we finished three, Jacob at Peniel, Genesis 32. I just noticed that there's a spelling mistake there. Peniel should have an E-L instead of an A-L. Number four is the loss of Joseph, Genesis 37. I'm not really going to discuss Genesis 37. We'll pick that up to some degree under Joseph himself. But I think it's good to mention it here when you think of Joseph's life. Certainly the loss of Joseph was a significant point, a turning point, because Joseph goes down to Egypt as his brothers sell him. And eventually that means the whole family of Jacob goes down into Egypt. So I just mentioned that then at this point. That's number four. Let's go on to five. Jacob's blessings in Genesis 49. Now, the entire chapter of Genesis 49 contains blessings that Jacob pronounces on each of his sons. They are reminiscent of the sort of thing that Noah did with his sons. Remember, he pronounced certain blessings and curses on Shem, Ham, and Japheth. Isaac blessed his sons in Genesis 27:27. And following, and Jacob, of course, prior to this, and what we mentioned in the last class hour, blessed the sons of Joseph, that is Ephraim and Manasseh. Now, with all of those formulations of blessings, you're really talking about something more than just Noah's desire or Jacob's desire or his wish for his sons. Because I think we must say that these blessings are inspired pronouncements of what is actually going to come to pass among the descendants of the people involved. So that these blessings are sort of programmatic for the future. And we saw that with the way it worked out with Noah's sons and the implications of that. And the same, of course, is true here. So I think they're properly understood as prophetic in character. And I think we must conclude that Jacob, by divine revelation, sees something of the future of each one of the tribes of Israel as he pronounces these blessings in chapter 49. I'm not going to go through the chapter and look at each of these pronouncements, but I do want to focus on the one for Judah, which is in verses 8 through 12. We read there, "Judah, your brothers will praise you. Your hand will be on the neck of your enemies. Your father's sons will bow down to you. You are a lion's cub, O Judah. You return from the prey, my son. Like a lion, he crouches and lies down like a lioness. Who dares to rouse him? The scepter will not depart from Judah, nor the ruler's staff from between his feet until he comes to whom it belongs. And the obedience of the nation is his. He will tether his donkey to a vine, his colt to the choicest branch. He will wash his garments in wine, his robes in the buds of grape. His eyes will be darker than wine, his teeth whiter than milk." Now, verse 10 of that particular blessing is very well known. Of course, it's significant. But when you look at the earlier part of the blessing, I think we see that the first phrase implies that the right of the firstborn is going to rest with Judah. Your brothers will praise you. And I think in that we have an indication that the line of promise that has proceeded from Abraham through Isaac to Jacob is now to be continued through Judah. Two things then are said of Judah. Something concerning his relation to his enemies and something concerning his relation to his brother. Your hand will be on the neck of your enemies and your father's sons will bow down to you. In other words, he will subject his enemies and his brothers are going to recognize his superiority. And then in verse 9, his glory is depicted in the imagery of a lion. "You are a lion's cub, O Judah. You return from the prey, my son, like a lion. He crouches, he lies down like a lioness. Who dares to rouse him?" And that brings us to the well-known statement. The scepter will not depart from Judah, nor the law, nor the ruler's staff from between his feet, until he comes to whom it belongs. Now the scepter is a word that is used to indicate royalty. It was a symbol of royal power. And the statement is, the scepter will not depart from Judah. Well, the implication certainly is that there's going to be royalty arise within Judah. So you get here the first explicit indication that there's to be a royal line in Israel. And that whole idea of kingship in Israel becomes a very significant thing later. It really isn't established until the time of Saul and David under Samuel after the period of judges. Israel's even in the land for a long time before kingship arises. But eventually it's established. It's anticipated back here in Genesis 49. Other things are said later in the book of Numbers by Balaam when he prophesies about the future of Israel. He also sees royalty in Israel. When you get to Deuteronomy, there's a law of the king in Deuteronomy to set out in advance when you do have a king, how the king should function. It really doesn't become set up till later. But in kingship, you see, you get the institution established that ultimately is the institution that points forward to the great messianic ruler of the future, which is of course, Christ himself, who will sit on the throne of David as the son of David. So kingship becomes an important theme. Here's the first intimation of it. Yes?
With respect to that, it's wrong. I have never noticed that before. You've always thought the first time he came was mentioned about the people was when they were after the judge or something.
Yeah, that's right.
But yet, there's wrong.
It's anticipated. And that's, I think, a mistaken. A lot of people are of the notion that kingship, there's no idea of it before it arose, and when it did arise, and it was something wrong.
Yeah.
And it's something really that they should never have asked for. Now, of course, we'll discuss that when we get to it. I think the issue there is not that. I think the issue is they wanted the wrong kind of a king, they wanted for the wrong reasons. But kingship in itself is not something that was not within God's plan for his people from the very beginning. So it's a very positive thing. Now, you see, the wrong kind of king and a king desired for the wrong reasons is something else, and that's the issue in 1 Samuel.
Well, this then first mention of that concept
That's
of
right.
kingship in the Bible?
That's right. Unless you can, you know, first explicit, I would say, although the name, you know, the word king isn't used here, the symbol of royal authority appears here. Unless you can say that implicitly, you go back to Genesis 3:15 and see the woman's going to crush the serpent, you may say implicitly the idea of royal power is involved in that. It's certainly not clear. This is the first explicit mention. The next phrase, I'm reading from the NIV. King James differs here. But the second phrase of the sentence, the scepter will not depart from Judah, nor the ruler's staff from between his feet. The NIV says, nor a lawgiver from between his feet. Which doesn't make a whole lot of sense. The problem is, in the Hebrew, it's the same word that can be translated either way. It seems, I think, best in the context to understand as the NIV does, the ruler's staff. The scepter will not depart from Judah, nor the ruler's staff from between his feet. Until a certain thing happens. And here again, you have a difference in translation. The King James says, until Shiloh come. And unto him, that is Shiloh, shall the gathering of the people be. Whereas the NIV says, until he comes to whom it belongs. And the obedience of the nations is his. Now the NIV does have a note, or until Shiloh comes, or until he comes to whom tribute belongs. Now, the reason for those different translations is, it's a very difficult phrase to translate from Hebrew. If you look at the Kyle Dalish commentary, which in Genesis is done by Kyle, he takes it as the King James translates, and translates it as Shiloh, until Shiloh comes. He has a lengthy discussion of the term in Hebrew, and concludes it's related to the root Shalah. From which probably the name of the city Shiloh, which is the place later when Israel comes into the land where the ark was located, from that root probably the name of that city is derived. The meaning of the root is to be quiet, at ease, to enjoy rest. To be quiet, to be at ease, to enjoy rest. And the idea of Shiloh then as the city where the ark was probably is the ark rested at Shiloh. But then Kyle says, Shiloh then might denote not only a place of rest, but a bearer of rest, the one who gives rest. And he concludes, therefore, that Shiloh here is to be understood as a name. And it's really a messianic designation. The one who brings or bears rest. So it's a title of the Messiah. And he says in that connection, we regard Shiloh, therefore, as a title of the Messiah in common with the entire Jewish synagogue and the whole Christian church, in which, although there may be uncertainty as to the grammatical interpretation of the word, there is perfect agreement as to the fact the patriarch is here proclaiming the coming of the Messiah. And you would have the reading then that this scepter shall not depart from Judah, or the lawgiver's staff from between his feet, until Shiloh come, Messiah come. Now others object to taking the Hebrew expression there as a proper name. And it's pointed out by those who translate it as the NIV do that taking it as a proper name or a title is found in no version earlier than the 16th century. And there's no other reference to Shiloh as a title of the Messiah anywhere else in the Bible. If this is a title for the Messiah, it's the only place in which it's used. And probably most importantly, references made to Ezekiel 21:27, where it seems that there's an allusion to this passage. In Ezekiel 21, you have in that chapter, 27 is the verse, although it's in the Hebrew it's verse 32. If you, some of you want to check it out in the Hebrew, it's not 27 in Hebrew, it's 21:32. But in this chapter, you have a prophecy concerning the coming destruction at the hands of the Babylonians on Judah and Jerusalem. The NIV entitles it Babylon, God's Sword of Judgment. And if you look at the second verse, it says, prophesy against the land of Israel and say to her, this is what the Lord says, I'm against you, I will draw my sword from its scabbard and cut off from you both the righteous and the wicked, because I'm going to cut off the righteous and the wicked, my sword shall be unsheathed against everyone from south to north. And you go down a bit further in end of verse 7, it says, it's coming, it will surely take place, says the Sovereign Lord. And then in verse 10, end of verse 9 and on into verse 10, a sword, sharpened and polished, sharpened for the slaughter, polished to flash like lightning. Then a question, shall we rejoice in the scepter of my son Judah? The sword despises every such stick. Now there's, you see, a reference to the scepter of Judah. Just because Judah has this scepter, is that going to protect you against this judgment? Well, the sword despises every such stick, is the statement in this chapter. Down to verse 13, testing will surely come. What if the scepter of Judah, which the sword despises, does not continue, declares the Sovereign Lord? Again, you see, it seems like an allusion back to Genesis 49:10, where it says that the scepter shall not depart from Judah. When you get down further in the chapter, you read verse 21, the king of Babylon will stop at the fork in the road, at the junction of two roads, to seek an omen. Here you have some insight on the ancient Near Eastern way of determining God's will, because it goes on to say he will cast lots with arrows, he will consult his idols, he will examine the liver. Remember, livers, configurations were considered a means of determining the will of God. Into his right hand will come the lot for Jerusalem, where he is to set up battering rams, to give the command to slaughter, to sound the battle cry, to set battering rams against its gates, and so forth. And you read the end of verse 24, it says, you're going to be taken captive. He's going to come against Jerusalem. And verse 26, the Lord says, take off the turban, remove the crown. It will not be as it was. The lowly will be exalted. The exalted will be brought low. A ruin, a ruin. I will make it a ruin. It will not be restored. And here's the allusion to 49:10. It will not be restored until he comes to whom it rightfully belongs. To him I will give it. It will not be restored until he comes to whom it rightfully belongs. Now, see, the NIV translates Genesis 49:10 that the scepter will not depart from Judah, the ruler's staff from between his feet, until he comes to whom it belongs. And the obedience of the nation is his. So, the wording at Ezekiel 21:27, which is 21:32 in the Hebrew, is different from the wording in Genesis 49:10. But most are convinced that what you have in 49:10, what you have, say, in the Ezekiel thing, is a longer version, you might say, of what you find in 49:10. 49:10, this is the Hebrew word, for those of you who have had any Hebrew, Shiloh. If you look it up in Brown, Driver, and Briggs' lexicon, you'll see apparently a noun, but probably equals Shalu, he whose it is comes, or that which belongs to him comes, which is a combination of Asher and Lo. Asher is which, lo is to him. So which is to him would be the idea of the combined form of this word. Sort of a shortened form of a share combined with lo. And you see down here in Ezekiel 21:32, you have until comes a share lo. That which is to him, hamishpat, that which is rightfully to him. Now, most of you, I realize, haven't had Hebrew, but I'm just trying to give you some idea of what the nature of the problem is with respect to translation of this. I think for myself, I would be inclined to go like the NIV does and to accept that the Ezekiel text is a parallel and sort of an expansion of the terminology of Genesis 49:10. If that's the case, it would mean that the Shiloh in 49:10 is not a proper name, but it's this he to whom it belongs idea. Whether you translate it Shiloh comes or he to whom it rightfully belongs comes makes no difference as far as the messianic character of the statement. In either case, you're pointing forward to the one to whom the scepter rightly belongs, whether you call that person Shiloh or just he to whom it rightly belongs. In Meredith Klein's commentary, in the New Bible Commentary Revised Edition, his comment on this verse is, Judah will continue to be the royal house until he to whom it, that is the scepter of kingship, belongs, comes. So Genesis 49:10 is a significant verse in the context of this movement of redemptive history. Because here you have not only the narrowing of the promise from Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, now to within Jacob, the tribe of Judah, but you also have the introduction of this idea of kingship into this unfolding of the promise. A king is going to rise out of Judah. Okay, any questions or comments? Yeah.
The comment, the expression that the scepter will not depart from Israel's history.
Is that
right?
Well,
that the scepter won't go to another tribe to stay with Judah. Because, you know, just the periods of captivity and all, there was no scepter.
Yeah. Yeah, I think the idea is it's a continuing line, even though there may be some gaps in the actual having of a person sitting on the throne of David, you might say. Certainly there was between 586 and the coming of Christ. But with the coming of Christ, it's true, some people were looking for him to take up that role of the Davidic king and in a very political way expel the Romans and reestablish his kingdom, which he didn't do in that geographical, political, earthly sense. But nevertheless, certainly he came as the son of David and, it seems to me, inaugurated the kingdom, at least in a provisional way, of course in a spiritual way. And we'll see the more complete, fuller manifestation of that yet. But that, of course, raises another issue with respect to the kingdom as to whether it was established in some sense at the first advent of Christ or waits to be established at the second advent. There are those who say it was established at the first advent and don't even see any future fuller realization of it except the eternal state. There are others who say it wasn't established at his first advent and every aspect of it remains yet to be realized. It seems to me that the Bible takes a middle ground to that. It's here in one sense, but it's still coming in another sense. And it's here, but it's not in its fullness. And the fullness remains yet to be realized. But I think the point, to get back to your question, is there's going to be an enduring dynasty that will last. You know, this promise is elaborated on with when it comes to narrowed down to David. Your house will endure forever, David is told. Really the same idea as this. Yes?
The translation,
that's not an alternate translation because you're taking it both ways if you do that. Does the NIV do that in their footnote? Oh, the NASB. Does it really? Read that to me. All right. Yeah, you could say until he comes to Shiloh. See, Av, Ki, Yavo, Shiloh, until he comes to Shiloh. Or until, there you take your subject out of the verb, until he comes, and Shiloh is then the place. Or you can make Shiloh the subject, until Shiloh comes. You could do that either way.
My question then is that, does this place Shiloh figure at all in the history of Israel, especially with respect to the time?
Doesn't seem to. Because, you know, it served as the location of the ark for a relatively short period of time during the time of the Judges, and was destroyed, probably by the Philistines. And the ark never returned there. And even the location of Shiloh is somewhat disputed. So, I think it's probably better to say until Shiloh comes, or, on the Ezekiel analogy, until he comes whose right it is. One of those two, rather than until he comes to Shiloh. All right, G on your sheet is Joseph. And one is Genesis 37:2. This is another of those structural dividing points in the book of Genesis. Because you notice 37:2 says, this is the account of Jacob. Now that's from the NIV, which somewhat obscures the Hebrew of that phrase. The King James says, these are the generations of Jacob. Remember, we discussed that expression. It's in the Hebrew, the toledot, generations of. What it's saying is, here's a new section, and the idea is, what is to follow is what's going to come out of Jacob, what's going to proceed forth from Jacob. And you have a new period here beginning in which you find the expansion of the chosen line to a people. Because from this point on, the focus is not just on Jacob, certainly not just on his personal experiences, even though those are involved, but on the events that prepared for the forming of the people of Israel. And that, of course, involves Joseph being sold down into Egypt by his brothers, the famine arising, eventually the whole family having to go down to Egypt to be preserved with the food that had been set aside there. And, of course, that is the means by which Israel, in the family of Jacob, goes down to Egypt, where they become a nation, and spend that 430 years in Egypt. All right, number two is the events of his life. I've sort of outlined that on your class lecture outline sheet. I'm not going to go through this chapter by chapter, a few comments on some of these points. Schultz has a summary on page 37 of the events of the life of Joseph, discussing Genesis 37 through 50. I might just say the Joseph narratives are some of the most dramatic in all literature. I think there's something significant happening here as far as redemptive history is concerned, but even apart from that, people who look at these narratives just from the standpoint of their literary artistic value tell us that these are some of the best narrative stories that you'll find in all of literature. And of course there's a lot of drama there. Joseph is sold by his brothers, he's put in prison unjustly. He interprets the dreams of the butler and the baker, then a pharaoh rises to be a ruler in Egypt, and then you have the brothers coming and all that interchange between the brothers where eventually then Joseph reveals himself as to who he is. So, you notice on your sheet, 37, he's taken to Egypt, and then 39 to 41, from slave to a ruler. his imprisonment, the interpretation of dreams. In prison, he meets the cupbearer of the Pharaoh and the baker of the Pharaoh. They had some dreams, and he tells them that the cupbearer is going to be restored to his position, the baker is going to be killed, and that's exactly what happens. He tells the cupbearer, when you are restored, remember me, speak to Pharaoh for me. You remember, you're reading the story, the cupbearer completely forgot. 2 years later, Pharaoh has a dream, and then he remembers, oh, there was that fellow back there in prison that knew how to interpret dreams. And so Joseph is called into Pharaoh and interprets then that dream of the seven fat cows and the seven lean cows and the withered grain and the prosperous grain as 7 years of prosperity and abundance, 7 years of famine. Tells Pharaoh, you really need to plan and provide during the 7 years of abundance. And Pharaoh then seeks out someone who can do that, and it turns out to be Joseph. Somebody had a question. Yes.
Just a matter of speculation, what do you think Joseph was hoping to get out of the butler, mentioning the fact that he was in prison?
I would think so. I think he probably hoped that this fellow would speak to the Pharaoh of his innocence.
So that he just
Yeah.
So he got more than he...
That's true. Though, you know, there's a lesson there from the other side. Of course, God's providence is in all this. But this matter of forgetting things that are important for other people, very easy thing to do. You know, some little thing that you could do that would be of enormous significance for someone else, very easy to just completely forget that and not take it seriously. And then, you know, there's no consequences for you, but big consequences. All right, C is Joseph's encounters with his brothers, Genesis 42 to 45. You have the first journey into Egypt without Benjamin. Remember, Benjamin was the second son of Rachel. Rachel was a favored wife. Joseph was the first son after a long time of barrenness. Finally, Joseph is born. And then Jacob loses Joseph. And then Benjamin's born, and giving childbirth, Rachel dies. And Benjamin then becomes the father's favorite. So when these other brothers go down into Egypt, Benjamin stays with Jacob and doesn't go down. But Simeon is detained by Joseph, because he inquired and found out about Benjamin. He says, well, the way you can show me you're not really spies is you go back. When you come back again, you bring Benjamin along with you. And when brothers go back and report that to Joseph, back to Jacob, it's very difficult for Jacob to say, all right, Benjamin can go. He finally agrees to do that. And in the second journey, Judah becomes a surety for Benjamin, and eventually then Joseph identifies himself. And then the children of Israel settle in Egypt. Goshen is given to them as a place to live. Then you have Jacob's blessings, Jacob's death and burial in Canaan, where they take him back up into the land of Canaan for burial. Now, that's just a brief resume of the flow of these narratives. I want to say something about the significance of these events in the context of redemptive history. We'll go back in and look at certain sections of the question first.
Sir, has there ever been, every time Joseph is presented, with one exception, where he tries to uncross Jacob's hand to correct that, is he ever presented as having failed? You know, all the other great men in the Bible, we always see where they have these failings. For Joseph, one who's been presented a man away from one.
Yeah, I think generally you're correct. And what has been associated with that then is a typological interpretation that Joseph, almost as a sinless man, points forward to Christ. There may be certain typological connections between Joseph and Christ. But I think you have to be careful how far you go with it. In 37:2, maybe this puts a little bit different light on Joseph, maybe not much. But at 37:2, you read, Joseph, a young man of 17, was tending the flocks with his brothers, the sons of Bilhah, the sons of Zilpah, his father's wives. He brought their father a bad report about them. Now here you have, you know, one brother coming back. Yeah, that's a good word. Yeah. And then when you go down to verse 5, you read he had a dream. When he told it to his brothers, they hated him all the more. He said to them, listen to this dream I had. We were binding sheaves of grain out in the field when suddenly my sheaf rose and stood upright while your sheaves gathered round mine and bowed down to it. His brother said to him, do you intend to reign over us? Will you actually rule us? Of course, they're denying this because they do bow down later in the story. But they hated him all the more because of his dream and what he had said. Then he had another dream. And he told it to his brothers. Listen, he said, I had another dream. And this time the sun and the moon and 11 stars were bowing down to me. When he told his father, as well as his brothers, his father rebuked him and said, what is this dream you had? Will your mother and I and your brothers actually come and bow to the ground before you? His brothers were jealous of him, but his father kept the matter in mind. Now, I don't know, but it seems to me through all that, his attitude is one of putting it on pretty heavy on his brothers. Now, true, I think God was revealing something to him in a dream that later was going to come to pass, but it seems to me that his attitude maybe wasn't all that it could have been in how he spoke of these things to his brother and to his father. But, so, I don't know, I think Joseph was a man like all other men, who had his good and his bad traits. I do think there are certain aspects of his life that may well have a typical significance. The man I studied with in Holland, who is N.H. Ritterbos, I think I mentioned that earlier in this course. Did I? All the Ritterbosses, the three Ritterbosses? Are you familiar with the name Ritterbos? You know, the well-known Ritterbos is Hermann Ritterbos, who wrote the volume on the coming of the kingdom, the outline of Paul's theology, and a number of commentaries. Hermann Ritterbos, but his initials are H.M. Ritterbos. Man I studied with, New Testament. Man I studied with is H. N. H. And he is Old Testament. And there was a father, Jay, who was also Old Testament. So there are two generations of Ritterbosses, but a father with two sons. One who was professor of New Testament at Compton Theological Seminary in Holland, and he was H.N. And the other son, who was N.H., who was professor of Old Testament at Free University. But N.H., Nico Ritterbos, said, the New Testament does not refer to Joseph as a type. This is a caution. But it does seem that in the Joseph stories, the theme of humiliation and later exaltation finds a higher realization in the person of Christ. Joseph as Christ preserves God's people from destruction. But then he adds, there are limits. Some treatments seem to border on allegory in finding detailed correspondences. And that's where he sort of backs off, which I think is kind of a healthy attitude. Yeah?
I also wonder whether in initial context this brother feels very unforgiving because he put them into prison and was after 3 days that he said to them, I fear God. I think over the 3 days he thought about his own actions.
It's possible. That's possible. It's certainly clear as time goes on that he does harbor no resentment and desires to take no revenge on the brothers. But, yeah, I think that's right. Okay, let's go on to three, the significance of these events in the context of redemptive history. I want to make just 2 points here. First one is, Joseph temporarily becomes prominent, although Judah is the line of the promised seed. Joseph temporarily becomes prominent, although Judah is the line of the promised seed. Now, in these Joseph stories, it appears that the tension between Leah and Rachel is continuing in their children. Because the first four sons of Leah, Reuben, Simeon, Levi, and Judah, are involved in that selling of the son of Rachel to the Egyptian, to the Midianite traders, by which he gets taken down to Egypt. Now, it's true, however, that Judah is the one who proposes to sell Joseph rather than kill him in 37:27. Come, let's sell him to the Ishmaelites, not lay our hands on him. After all, he is our brother, our own flesh and blood. Reuben, it appears, really wanted to free, because in verse 21, when Reuben heard this, he tried to rescue him from their hands. Let's not take his life, he said. And then throw him into this cistern in the desert, but don't lay a hand on him. Reuben said this to rescue him from them, take him back to his father. But when he came back, verse 29, he finds Joseph's not there. He tore his clothes and went back to his brothers and boys in there. Where can I turn now? So it does seem that Reuben really wasn't too much a part of that. But in any case, it does seem that a measure of this conflict is continuing in the children. In addition, Judah's conduct in the previous chapter, or not in the previous chapter, in the next chapter, chapter 38, which is sort of a parenthesis in this sequence of narratives about Joseph, is not the character you might expect out of the one through whom that promises line is going to continue. Because chapter 38 tells of Judah's relationship with Tamar, who was his son's former wife. That is Judah's son's former wife. And her husband died. And at a certain point, she didn't have another husband, and the other sons of Judah were not willing to perform that levirate obligation with respect to her. Judah's out on the road, and Caesar mistakes her for a harlot and has a sexual relationship with her, out of which children are born. And you read in verse 16, not realizing she was his daughter-in-law, he went over to her by the roadside and said, come now, let me sleep with you. Verse 24, about 3 months later, Judah was told, your daughter-in-law Tamar is guilty of prostitution. As a result, she's pregnant. Judah said, bring her out and have her burned to death. As she was being brought out, she sent a message to her father-in-law, I'm pregnant by the man who owns these, she said. See if you recognize whose seal, cord, and staff these are. Judah recognized them and said, she's more righteous than I, since I wouldn't give her to my son Shelah. And he did not sleep with her again. But the children are born, and you read in verse 29, but when he drew back his hand, his brother came out. She said, so this is how you have broken out. He was named Perez. Then his brother, who had the scarlet thread on his wrist, came out. He was given the name Zerah. Now, the interesting thing is about Perez. Perez becomes a link in the line of Judah to Christ. If you look at Ruth 4:18-22, the end of the book of Ruth, you read, this is the family line of Perez. Perez was the father of Hezron. Hezron the father of Ram. Ram the father of Abinadab. Abinadab, so forth. 21, Salmon, the father of Boaz, Boaz, father of Obed, Obed, the father of Jesse, Jesse, the father of David. So you see in the line down to David, you find Perez, and over in Matthew 1, where you have the genealogy of Christ, verse 3 of Matthew 1, Judah, the father of Perez, and Zerah, those two sons of Judah by Tamar, whose mother was Tamar, Perez, the father of Hezron, and so forth. So, it's not the sort of conduct you might expect, but you see, I think we've seen that a number of times. God works his redemptive purposes out in spite of the sinful actions of man. But during this time, Joseph is prominent. He's sold by his brethren, but that serves ultimately to preserve the children of Israel, bring them back together again. I see my time's about up. I guess we'll have to stop here. And I'll pick up at this point next quarter the significance of these events in the context of redemptive history. We've looked just at one point. Joseph temporarily becomes prominent, although Judah is the line of the prophecy. Okay.